Iran censures the UN for refusing to blacklist Israel and the Saudi coalition over their crimes against Palestinian and Yemeni children. Syrian media report that a U.S. military base in eastern Syria's Al Omar oil field has been targeted with missiles. Also, Ethiopia's federal government declares a unilateral ceasefire in its war-torn Tigray region as rebels take control of the regional capital, Mekelle. Beginning with our top story, Iran's ambassador to the United Nations has criticized the world body for excluding Israel and the Saudi-led coalition from its list of violators of children's rights. Majid Tahrir-Avanchi said the most systematic and gross violation of the rights of children in West Asia continues by the Israeli regime. He cited UN data that showed over 1,000 cases of Israeli violations against 340 Palestinian children. Tahrir-Avanchi also said over 3,500 children have been killed in the Saudi-led war on Yemen, as stated by a UN report. The UN Secretary General added Yemen's Ansarullah movement to the blacklist, citing an alleged use of child soldiers. Yemen, however, has vehemently rejected the accusation. Political commentator Jafar Ramini says the United Nations was created as a tool for Western powers to make the rest of the world believe they are upholders of democratic and human values. Here's more.
Nobody should look for any justice or any humanity from the UN. The UN was created as a tool for Western powers to show that they are democratic and they have human values. Nothing of the sort. While you have America in there exercising the right of veto, nothing tangible or nothing human will happen. Israel is protected. They are the favorite child of the United States of America. And so is Saudi Arabia. And if there is this sacred cow called the West's interest that should be protected at any cost. And if you look at the social media, there is every day at least a dozen pictures of Palestinian children of the age of 7, 8, and 9, and sometimes even 5, are dragged brutally by the Israeli occupation forces, put in prison, not allowed access by their parents or legal representation.
Iran has marked the 1981 bombing of the headquarters of the Iran Islamic Republic Party by the U.S.-backed Mujahideen-e-Khalq terror organization known as the MKO. The occasion is marked every year as part of week-long ceremonies dubbed the American Human Rights Week. Youssef Jalali reports.
Rights activists, along with families of terror victims in Iran, attended this gathering in Tehran to mark the American Human Rights Week. The annual occasion aims to shed light on the U.S.'s record of rights violations in Iran.
We're marking the American Human Rights Week to review the numerous cases where the U.S. openly violated human rights in our country, like the American Navy's downing of our passenger plane in 1988, after which the perpetrators received a badge of honor in the U.S. The latest crime the U.S. has committed was to assassinate the spearhead of the fight against terrorism, General Qasem Soleimani.
The second day of the week-long occasion marks the 1981 bombing of the headquarters of the Iran Islamic Republic Party in Tehran by the U.S.-backed Mujahideen-e-Khalq terror organization, known as the MKO. 73 leading officials of the Islamic Republic were killed, including former Justice Chief Ayatollah Muhammad Ali Beheshti.
Iran says it has lost over 17,000 people in terrorist attacks. 12,000 of them were killed at the hands of the formidable MKO terrorist group. What's even more shocking is that the U.S. does not regard the MKO as a terrorist entity and has even established intimate ties with them.
The U.S. and Europe delisted the MKO as a terrorist organization following this measure the group was relocated from its former stronghold at a U.S. military base in Iraq to Albania and France. Ever since, the MKO has held regular meetings with American and European officials.
Members of U.S. Congress regularly meet MKO leaders where they offer any kind of support to the terrorist group. The U.S. is still supporting the terrorists in their anti-Iran campaigns. The MKO killed our top nuclear scientists, and that was not possible without the U.S. and Israel's assistance.
I lost my husband in the 1981 bombing of the Islamic Republic Central Office by the MKO. Interestingly, the spearhead of the terrorist operation, whose real name is Ali Mohtamed, took refuge in the Netherlands, and they welcomed him until a few years ago when the MKO disposed of him as a lost cause.
The American Human Rights Week started on June 27th, which marks the anniversary of the failed assassination of the then Iranian president Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei by the MKO terrorists in 1981, and will end on July the 3rd, which coincides with the anniversary of the U.S. Navy's shooting down of an Iranian passenger plane in 1988. Organizers of the occasion say the ultimate goal of the week-long ceremonies is to expose the U.S.'s double standards when it comes to the issue of human rights. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Syrian media say several rockets have been fired at a U.S. military base at the Al Omar oil field located in the country's east. Reports say the attack caused damage, but no casualties to the base. This comes less than 24 hours after the U.S. airstrikes targeted positions of Iraq's popular mobilization units on both sides of the Iraq-Syria border. Our correspondent to Syria, Lisa Saf.
Mortar shells were fired, and they hit a U.S. Base in an area in the Al-Zour countryside in, of course, Al Omar oil field. The mortar shells hit and targeted a U.S. base over there. This is according to the state news agency over here in Syria. We still don't have any comments from the United States on this particular attack. In fact, this is one of the largest and most richest oil fields in Syria, Al Omar oil field, which is in Deir ez-Zor countryside. It is occupied by the United States. The United States occupies many parts of Syria in the north, where it is a rich area of oil. It is giving all of that oil to the Kurdish side, so-called Syria's Democratic Forces, and also using some of that oil in order to finance its presence inside Syria and Iraq.
More on that. As I said, the U.S. military has carried out fresh airstrikes on positions of Iraq's popular mobilization units on both sides of the Iraqi-Syrian border. The Pentagon claims it hit militants involved in attacks on U.S. interests in Iraq, but the PMU has strongly rejected the allegation. We have a report.
The Pentagon confirmed it carried out airstrikes on positions of Iraq's popular mobilization units on both sides of the country's border with Syria. The Pentagon claimed the Sunday night strikes were defensive and in retaliation for what it called the PMU's drone attacks on U.S. personnel and facilities in Iraq. But the PMU forces roundly rejected any involvement. They said they are part of Iraq's regular armed forces and that the soldiers who died in the U.S. raids were guarding the border. The PMU forces warned that they are ready to take revenge. The U.S. airstrikes are the second of their kind to be ordered by President Joe Biden against the PMU since he took office in January. Biden says the strikes are meant to end what he calls for forces attacks on U.S. interests, but Iraqis see things differently.
The Iraqi people, government, officials, factions, and political figures see this attack as a boon to Daesh and other terrorists in Iraq and Syria. Through this attack, the U.S. seeks to weaken PMU forces in Iraqi and Syrian border areas so that Daesh terrorists can enter the Iraqi territory and carry out terrorist attacks. Effectively, the U.S. is now standing united with Daesh against the people of Iraq and its interests.
The strikes have been condemned across the political spectrum in Iraq. Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi denounced the airstrikes as a blatant and unacceptable violation of Iraq's sovereignty and its national security. The Iraqi military also issued a rare statement saying the U.S. move was a breach of the country's sovereignty. Different factions in the Iraqi parliament also condemned the airstrikes and called for steps to ensure such attacks will not repeat. They say the solution is ending the U.S. military presence in Iraq. That would be in line with a resolution adopted by the Iraqi parliament in January 2020 which called on the government to end the presence of all foreign troops in the country. The Iraqi parliament passed a resolution days after the U.S. assassinated Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani, along with a deputy commander of the PMU forces, Abu Mehdi al-Mohandes, in an airstrike near Baghdad airport. The U.S. has carried out more airstrikes on PMU positions ever since. During the period, Daesh terrorists have been the only other perpetrator of attacks on the popular forces.
Angry reactions are pouring in against the recent U.S. airstrikes on the positions of Iraq's popular mobilization units on both sides of the Iraq-Syria border. Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, condemned the attack, saying such hostile actions make the Iraqi nation more determined to oust the occupiers from their country. It added that the strikes against PMU positions are a clear violation of the sovereignty of both Iraq and Syria. Meanwhile, Yemen's Ansarullah movement said the attack was in line with the U.S. aerial support for al-Qaeda and Daesh terror groups in the region. Ansarullah also hailed the PMU for its resistance against what it called evil plots of Americans and Israelis. The Syrian government also slammed the U.S. airstrikes as, quote, a flagrant violation of the sanctity of Syrian and Iraqi lands. The UN Human Rights Chief has called for immediate dismantling of systemic racism against black people around the world. Let's take a listen.
I'm calling on all states to stop denying and start dismantling racism, to end impunity and build trust, to listen to the voices of people of African descent, and to confront past legacies and deliver redress.
Bachelet was commenting on a global report sparked by the gruesome police killing of African-American George Floyd. She said police use of racial profiling and excessive force is entrenched in much of North America, Europe, and Latin America. The report said the dehumanization of blacks has cultivated a tolerance for racial discrimination. It added that at least 190 black people died worldwide at the hands of law enforcement officials in the past decade, most of them in the U.S. A supervisor of the report said that with an exception of George Floyd case, no one was held accountable. Floyd was killed by a white officer in the U.S. city of Minneapolis last year. Ethiopia has declared a unilateral ceasefire in the Flashpoint Tigray region, signaling a turning point in a months-long conflict there. The truce comes after the former governing party there said it was back in control of the regional capital, Mekelle. In November, the central government launched an offensive to oust Tigray's dissident regional leadership, promising a swift victory. But the ongoing conflict has triggered a humanitarian crisis, pushing some 350,000 people to the brink of famine. Both sides of the conflict have been accused of committing war crimes. The whole globe is grappling with COVID-19 as the novel coronavirus continues to take lives. Some nations have come up with mass vaccination programs to protect their people. Only few have successfully developed homegrown COVID vaccine to immunize their people against the virus. Iran is in the vanguard of this medical development as it prepares to speed up its vaccination drive with homegrown coronavirus jabs. Here's more.
Inhumane sanctions imposed on Iran by the West and the U.S. have hampered the country's efforts to purchase vaccines. The sanctions not only targeted the Iranian oil and banking sector, but also hit pharmaceutical companies and are in violation of the U.N. Charter. Meanwhile, the United States has recently issued a guide to pave the way for the delivery of masks, respirators, and vaccines to countries subject to severe sanctions, such as Iran. That's 16 months after the beginning of the pandemic, when the Islamic Republic has made its vaccine and over 82,000 Iranians have died from the coronavirus. The Islamic Republic has managed to join the few countries around the world developing vaccines to fight the coronavirus disease by producing its first domestic COVID-19 vaccine, known as Coviran Barakat. Iran will focus on using three locally made COVID-19 vaccines, including Russia's Sputnik V and the vaccine jointly produced with Cuba, named Pasteur-Covac vaccine. Iran has also launched a clinical trial of yet another vaccine, dubbed Nura, as part of its drive to develop COVID-19 jabs. Iran is also participating in the COVAX scheme. That's why the United Nations had previously slammed a group of seven wealthy nations for failing to come up with a plan to vaccinate the world against COVID-19. For months, the United States, Britain, and Canada practiced vaccine hoarding, even as poorer nations elsewhere had yet to even distribute doses to their medical workers on the front lines of the pandemic. The U.S., its European allies, and their sanctions regime have targeted ordinary Iranian citizens who are facing one of the worst global health crises. Meanwhile, Iran has managed to develop local vaccines amid cruel sanctions and is prepared to mass-produce jabs to provide the world.
Firstly, it says that the Islamic Republic of Iran has a moral medical obligation. It's actually not necessarily trying to profiteer from this vaccine, as with the Pfizer and other vaccines, which are charging very high rates even here. They're making money out of it. It's basically big business. The Islamic Republic of Iran, clearly at something like $8 a shot, isn't profiteering. And I think that, in a way, is one thing which is very positive. The other thing it says about Iran is that it has an ability to do things itself. This advancement in medical fields, in technological fields, scientific fields, bodes very well for Iran's future. It's not relying on the West.
Thank you, World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump's first impeachment for abusing his power in approaches to Ukraine attracted one Republican vote, that of the Utah Senator Mitt Romney. In his second, for inciting the deadly U.S. Capitol attack, 10 House Republicans and 7 in the Senate voted for Trump's guilt. We now present you an article written by Martin Pengelly. Under the heading, Donald Trump returns to campaign trail with rally targeting Ohio Republicans. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Former U.S. President Donald Trump returned to the campaign trail with a rally in Ohio on Saturday night, 26th of June, campaigning against the Republican who voted for his impeachment and trailing his own candidacy for president in 2024. Trump repeated his baseless election 2020 grievances and painted a dystopian picture of the country under Democratic control, while in another echo of the past, the crowd chanted "Lock her up" at the mention of Hillary Clinton, the Democrat he defeated back in 2016. The rally outside Cleveland, Ohio, on Saturday, 26th of June, was to support Max Miller, a former White House aide, challenging Anthony Gonzalez, a former college football and NFL star censured by his state party for voting for Donald Trump's impeachment. While he praised Miller as an incredible patriot and a so-called great guy who purportedly loves the people of Ohio, Trump spent much of the rally fixating on the 2020 presidential election, which he insists he won. This is despite top state and local election officials, his own attorney general, and numerous judges, including some that he had appointed himself, saying there is no evidence of the mass voter fraud that Trump alleges took place. He told the crowd, which at one point broke into a Trump won chant, the 2020 presidential election was rigged. He added, "We won that election in a landslide." When Marjorie Taylor Greene, a far-right Republican from Georgia, known for her incendiary rhetoric, asked the crowd who their president is, they boomed loudly, "Trump." She said, "President Trump is my president too." The event had many of the trappings of the rallies Donald Trump held as a candidate and as president. There was the eclectic playlist, the same stage design, and many familiar volunteers. In the lead-up to the event, Donald Trump told a conservative Newsmax channel, "We're giving tremendous endorsements. Fake Republicans, anybody that voted for the impeachment doesn't get it, but there weren't too many of them. And I think most of them are being primaried right now, so that's good. I'll be helping their opponent." Donald Trump's first impeachment for abusing his power in a protest to Ukraine attracted one Republican vote, that of Utah Senator Mitt Romney. In his second impeachment for inciting the deadly U.S. Capitol attack, 10 House Republicans and 7 in the Senate voted for Trump's guilt. Donald Trump was acquitted twice, but banned from major social media platforms over his role in the Capitol attack. Regardless, he dominates the Republican Party. All bar one of the House Republicans who voted against him have attracted challengers. The 10th, John Katko of New York, co-authored a proposal for an independent 9/11-style commission to investigate the 6th of January attack on Congress, in which a mob roamed the Capitol looking for lawmakers to capture or kill in an attempt to overturn the election result. Senate Republicans blocked it. By Saturday afternoon, traffic was backed up from the fairgrounds into town, where pro-Trump signs dotted residents' lawns. On street corners, vendors sold Trump 2024 flags and other merchandise as supporters arrived. Marjorie Taylor Greene, a far-right congresswoman from Georgia who was stripped of her committee assignments over a number of extreme comments, mingled with attendees and took pictures. Donald Trump has said he didn't win the election, but has not formally conceded defeat by Joe Biden, and continues to voice his lie that the loss was the result of electoral fraud. On Friday, he told Newsmax he would be making an announcement in the not-too-distant future about whether he will run again, and said supporters were going to be thrilled by election results in 2024. He said, "We want a little time to go by, maybe watch what happens in 2022. In 2022 midterm elections, Republicans hope to retake the House and the Senate. Donald Trump's legal problems mounted on Friday, 25th of June, as his own lawyer confirmed that charges are likely in the investigation of the Trump Organization by the Manhattan District Attorney. The company's chief financial officer, Alan Weisselberg, and the company itself are in prosecutor's sights. Some observers point out that Donald Trump's many legal problems did not stop him winning the presidency back in 2016, and are unlikely to put off many Republican voters should he run again for the White House. In his Newsmax interview, the former president referred to his problems and to those affecting Rudy Giuliani, Donald Trump's lawyer and loyal ally. The former New York mayor this week saw his law license suspended over his advancement of Donald Trump's election fraud lie. Trump said, "Right now, I'm helping a lot of people get into office, and we're fighting the deep state, and we're fighting the radical left. They're after me. They're after Rudy. They're after you, probably. They're after anybody." The deep state conspiracy theory holds that a permanent government of bureaucrats and operatives exists to thwart Donald Trump. Steve Bannon, Trump's campaign chairman in 2016, then a White House strategist and chief propagator of the theory, has said it is for nutcases. Donald Trump went on, "They're vicious, and they don't do a good job, and they're very bad for the country, but I've been fighting them for 5.5 years. He said, "Since I came down the escalator at Trump Tower in New York in June of 2015 to announce his run for president, I've been fighting them. These are vicious people. I honestly believe they don't love this country." Donald Trump has spent much of his post-presidency at his Florida resort and his golf course in New Jersey. He also told Newsmax he was working very hard, not only for 2024, but we're working very hard to show the corruption of what took place in 2020. And then we see what happens. Donald Trump's rallies have been an instrumental part of his brand since he launched his 2016 presidential campaign. The former president often test drives new material and talking points to see how they resonate with crowds. His political operation uses the events to collect critical voter contact information and as fundraising tools.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear listeners, and here is a piece of advice from Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Riza, peace be upon him, on the necessity of avoiding a social ill that has unfortunately pervaded the contemporary world. "The most hateful thing to Allah amongst the lawful acts is divorce."
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Thank you. this man changed the world.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello, and welcome to our audience, and particularly a warm welcome to our listeners to our program, The Man Who Changed the World. This is a program that is about the life and times of Imam Khomeini. May God bless his soul. And once again, I'm your host for this program, Ijaz Hussain, and I also have my good friend, Dr. Mahdi Turabi, on the line. And I'd just like to say salam and welcome him to the program.
Alaykum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you, Dr. Mahdi Turabi. We are speaking about the man who changed the world, and we've got to the stage where we discussed some personality and characteristics of the Imam, of course, in the last sessions we had. But today we're going to talk about how Imam Khomeini has revived put religion on the map in terms of the fact both as far as Islam is concerned and as far as spirituality is concerned around the globe. Dr. Mahdi Turabi, your take on that?
Well, I think one of the important features or one of the important effects or consequences of having a personality like Imam enter the scene was exactly that, what you mentioned, which is that it really was all about reviving Islam. And because at that time we lived in a world where, you know, the Western civilization was dominant.
Yes.
And in that civilization, religion was really becoming a secondary issue.
Yes, it
was. Or was becoming something that was marginal or that was, you know, related to a minority of the population.
Sure.
And then if you look at all the intellectual climate of that time in that dominant civilization, it was, you know, pretty much across the board secular, whether it was left-wing secular, you know, Marxist or liberal secular, or even on the right. If you look at, you know, movements such as neoconservatism or the kind of secular right wing, if you look at the States or if you look at Thatcher in Britain.
Yeah, yeah. Reminded me of the Iron Lady again, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, Jesus.
There really wasn't any more space for any kind of religious discourse.
Sure.
Or the religious discourse that was marginalized.
It was very much marginalized. You're absolutely right.
Or it was, you know, labeled as just, you know, fundamentalist and whatever. And of course, this also relates to Christianity and the inability of Christianity at that time, and still, I would argue today, to really.
To cope with the issues of today. That's absolutely right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so here we had, and in Islam, we had a similar situation in the sense that when you had the those branches of Islam that didn't follow the school of Ahlul Bayt, they were also confronted with this inability to really offer solutions to, you know, the believers or the people.
Sure.
Maybe less so than Christianity, but still there was a lot of problems.
Sure.
That they
I
were
mean,
confronted with.
To be honest, Dr. Mahdi Turabi, the thing is that, you know, hindsight's a great thing, you know, and when we look back on the situation, I mean, when we see what the hell is going on in the Middle East with the Takfiris and all the rest of it, we can certainly understand that, you know, why they were not able to cope with anything, because they're pretty much in the pocket of the West, at the, you know, even today. So,
well, of course. I mean, that's one aspect of it when you're talking about Takfiris and Al Saud and that kind of branch.
Yeah,
of things.
Our favorite topic.
I'm also talking about, you know, so-called mainstream or, you know, moderate Sunnism.
Absolutely.
Which, because of certain
deficiencies.
Yeah, deficiencies as it relates to, and I'll be very specific, for example, that they don't accept logic or logical reasoning.
That's
in their theology,
to be honest, you know, Muntik
was a problem. You know, when you want to deal with when you want to deal with life, when you want to deal with living, you know, in the world on a daily basis and trying to help people, because, you know, what's the point of having a religion if it's just based on, you know, I'm just going to have personal prayer, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
exactly.
Who needs a religion like that? You know?
Exactly.
And we talked about this, as you may have.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing that, you know, as you say, that even Mantiq was completely dropped by many Sunni madrasas. They don't even study it now. They don't even look at it.
Again, I mean, you know, we have to look at why would we, you know, this is a completely secularized and westernized, modernized version of religion, what is a lot of people have in their head, which is that it's just this personal thing. Well, of course, religion is not just a personal thing.
Absolutely.
You know, and this is the problem that we have is, you know, why do we even, you know, what's the point of having a religion if it's just a personal thing, you know?
Yeah.
A religion has to be involved socially, has to care about justice, has to care about fighting evil, and has to care about, you know, offering solutions to daily problems. It has to help people.
Sure.
It's not just there to, you know, make them feel good, okay? Which is what Christianity had become, or has become in many instances.
Absolutely.
And so we had these fundamental structural historical problems with religion that, you know, was, and as a result, the religion was completely leaving the lives of people. It was no longer a factor in the lives of many people.
Sure.
And so, because, as we claim, you know, we have that very pure and real school of Ahlul Bayt, which is the closest that we have to the real deen, the real deen al-Haq. Because remember, from an Islamic perspective, we don't have different religions. We have one religion.
Absolutely.
It's the latest version.
Yes.
And the final version.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the final version of it.
It's the final version of it, yes.
Right?
Yes.
So it's not like we can say, well, you know, we have Christianity and Islam and Judaism. Yes, we do, and on a certain level when we're talking about, you know, legally speaking.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
In terms of, you know, the followers of the Ahl al-Kitab having rights and, you know,
yes, from a completely fifth point of view, yes, that's right.
Right.
Yes.
But in terms of the reality of it, in terms of what it is that God has revealed to his creation and the risala that is being, you know, given as guidance to humanity, well, we only have one religion, which
that's
is Deen al-Haq, as it says in the Quran, which is, you know, the religion that was revealed to the Prophet, peace be upon him.
Exactly. And that's perfect. That's complete.
And it happens to be called Islam.
Yes.
And in that religion, you have the unfortunate events that occurred after the demise of the Prophet, peace be upon him, that, you know, which is why a certain group within Islam say that they follow the school of Ahl al-Bayt.
Yes.
The family of the Prophet.
Sure.
And so it is that school out of which Imam Khomeini comes out of.
Exactly.
And it is that pure and what he called the Muhammadi Islam.
The Muhammadi Islam, that's right. He used to say the pure Muhammadan Islam, yes.
Pure Muhammadan Islam, as opposed to, remember what he used to call it?
American Islam.
American Islam.
Yeah, Salami Amiriki.
Which is that Islam, which is, oh, you know, don't get involved in social matters,
exactly.
Don't get involved in political matters,
yes.
It's just a personal thing, you know. You know,
just have a KFC next to the Kaaba, eh?
Well, and again, I mean, you know, it's funny you mentioned that because I think that's so symbolic and that's such a clear example of, you know, what's the, they always talk about, you know, you know, isn't that the biggest perversion itself that you would eat?
Yeah.
Even if it's halal, because they talk about, well, it's halal. You know, it's halal. You know, we have halal KFC. Or we have
halal KFC
McDonald's,
next to the car.
Or halal McDonald's.
Yeah.
Or halal whatever.
My God.
And, you know, isn't that just, you know, doesn't that say everything about how they don't understand anything?
Prophet Ibrahim, peace be upon him, missed out on that one.
Right, I mean, you know, forget about Zamzam.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
he should have had a huge diet coke.
That just shows that, you know, 1,400 years and they're still jahil.
They're still jahil, absolutely. Thank you for that.
This is the point, you know. And, you know, just look at the ugly stuff they're building there. I mean, it's horrendous what they're doing.
It's horrible what they've done to the place.
You're going to get me started on this now, but
I'd like to get you started, Dr.
Just give it the full treatment. What Imam Khomeini did was a revival.
Yes.
Not what they're doing.
No, not what they're doing. Absolutely.
This is like, you know, just a, how should I say it? These are like a bunch of ignorant people who just recently, you know, as we say, recently became became literate or recently, discovered indoor plumbing. And look at what they're doing to Mecca and Medina.
It's a catastrophe.
Destroying on a grand scale.
Of
Islam.
Yeah.
And this is something. I mean, I really wonder at some of these Muslims, and I'm talking Shia and Sunni.
Yeah.
Like, do you care that they're destroying all the history of Islam? Do you even care about that?
Yeah. I mean,
do you care about the fact that they're destroying?
You?
They're destroying the Prophet's house, Hazrat Khadija's house. They're destroying all the historic mosques.
Sure.
Do you care about that? You don't really care, do you? Because if you did, you would do something about it.
You would do something about it, exactly.
But well, we don't. We don't care. And it's actually coming up recently. It's going to come up in a few days. I think it's the 8th or 9th of Shawwal where they destroyed Baqi, when they took over Baqi after the Ottomans.
Sure.
Okay? So you have Jannat al-Baqi, which is, the historic, graveyard in Islamic history, where you have, Imam Hassan alayhi salam, you have Imam Sajjad alayhi salam.
Yes, you have several.
Muhammad alayhi salam, you have Imam Sadr alayhi salam.
That's
you have
right. Four, four
you
great
have,
Imams are buried.
You have, besides these, illustrious and luminous, personalities, you have tens and hundreds of others from the beginning of Islam that are buried.
Buried there,
and look,
absolutely.
And look at it today. You go there and it's like dust and, they got it, whatever. And so these are the people that are supposed to be the guardians of Islam and the guardians of the holy sites.
No,
and
they're not guardians
of
anything.
They're building Big Ben,
Yeah, they're building Big Ben. You're right.
They're building a little bit of London down there. They're building this monster version of Big Ben on top of the Kaaba. That's who they are. I mean, all I'm trying to say to you is, do you really want a six-fold Big Ben shadow over the Kaaba? Is that really because that's what's happening right now? You're doing tawaf and there's a shadow of Big Ben over. I mean, isn't that symbolic of who their master is, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, Mecca's in London now, so I might as well go there. I might find the Kaaba somewhere around there, next to the Parliament building.
They moved the Kaaba to the Westminster. Might as well.
Yeah. Oh my God, that says
so,
everything.
So what we're talking about is a real revival. We're not talking about this show that they're putting on.
Sure,
absolutely. And so that's the thing is, you had this real pure Islam, which was almost forgotten, which they really tried hard to suppress for centuries.
Yes, that's a very good point.
Whether it was
in Iraq,
or whether it was in Iran or whether it was in Lebanon, where they were trying to, label the people who follow that school as, kafir or as whatever.
Exactly.
And then a personality like Imam, Allah brings him, and, how can you deny him?
This was the exact problem they couldn't deny him. They couldn't deny him.
I'm talking about your average Sunni Muslim around the world.
He was completely taken aback.
Right. Anybody who has a genuine love for Allah and for the Prophet, peace be upon him, in the
very
heart, which
point.
Is what 97% of the Muslims have.
Sure.
Sunni and Shia. So don't get me wrong. I'm trying to say that.
No.
It's that tiny, small fraction of Nasibi Takfiri, agents of the West who have a problem with people like Imam. Why would any Muslim in the world have a problem with Imam?
No, I don't think they did have a problem.
They didn't.
Yeah, they didn't.
They had
the posters of Imam Khomeini out everywhere.
Right. So nobody had a problem. From Indonesia to Senegal, from Bosnia to,
right across the Arab world.
Right. I mean, to Central Africa. I mean, everybody was like, hey, this guy's cool. We want, this is what we were waiting for,
Yeah, the pictures are still up in New Delhi in India as well as
right.
Nigeria.
This is what we were waiting for a real leader in Islam who, is proud to be Muslim, who is not, who understands that Islam is going to give you the solutions in your life.
Yeah.
And who is not trying to, modify Islam to make it a little bit more, socialist or a little bit more liberal or a little bit more westernized bit more easternized, whatever.
Yeah.
So it's like, this is it. It's Islam as it was revealed in the Quran, as the Sunnah of the Prophet as it was, and as, Imam Ali alayhi salam after the Prophet continued to guide.
Sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, the thing is, this was the real McCoy, as we would say in Scotland.
Right. And so, exactly. Exactly. The real McCoy. And so the point is that, of course, this is going to lead to a spiritual revival around the world, because this is what humanity
was looking for. Exactly.
And remember, you know, our creation is not separate from Islam. You know, Islam was created, was revealed for our souls.
Yes.
For our being.
For our being, for our very existence.
Right. It's like the software for you know, our soul.
Exactly.
It's like the instruction manual or the program or the algorithm for our soul. I mean, you're the engineer,
absolutely. I mean, I couldn't have put it better myself. I mean, if you take a laptop, it's exactly that. I mean, it's like Windows.
It's like
the operating system.
Whatever.
It's the operating system.
Like
exactly.
You know, it's not only
system.
The operating system. It's the machine code that the operating system is.
Why are we sounding like the Matrix now all of a sudden? But anyway, the thing is that you're absolutely right. I mean, that's
the thing.
Yeah.
You know, this is not separate from humanity.
No, it is not.
You know, why are we surprised about this? Mm. Why are we looking at this thing only from a historical perspective?
It's not history. That's right. It's not history.
You have humanity, both individuals and humanity as a whole, who are thirsting for this guidance from Allah.
Exactly. Exactly.
And so you have these religions which are atrophied, like Christianity, like certain branches of Islam, which are not capable of.
No, they're not. You're right. They have atrophied.
Very need, are not able to, you know, quench that thirst that the soul has.
Yes.
And here it is. Here it is. Mm. You know. Islam of Ahlul Bayt with an amazing, you know, person like Imam being able to present it to the world.
Exactly. And it caused a huge reverberation and revival right across even the Western world, because the statistics speak for themselves.
Right, and this is more, and you know, I'm also saying this to fellow Shias, you know, this is more than just, advertising the religion. This is more than just explaining this is way beyond your traditional, you know, things that a scholar does, or like writing a book or holding a speech. This is about living it.
Living it. Now there's the key.
Okay.
Because
this is the point. Mm. And this is something that, and I'm addressing this more to the Shias, which is we have a problem in our religious culture.
Mm.
Which is we think that all we have to do is, you know, do tabligh.
Yes.
All we have to do is explain the laws.
No, you have
to live it.
You have to live this religion. Exactly. Absolutely.
It's not about just, you know, I'm going to tell you what religion is, or this is what the ayah says, or this is what the hadith says.
Sure.
It's about, okay, now implement it in your life.
Exactly.
Okay? And it's interesting. If you look at Imam's book, especially if you look at, you know, Islamic government,
That's right.
If you look at all his other books, his point, one of the main points, one of the main themes of Imam Khomeini is that Islam is about action. It's not about just talking about it.
Exactly.
Or having a class about it, or getting an A on your fiqh exam of, you know, I knew all the ahkam. Okay? It's about implementing it.
Living it.
Right. Islam is not, as he used to say, tatil. It's not closed. You know, the shop is not closed.
No.
It's open.
It's open.
You know?
It's open till the day of judgment.
Right. Just because we're in Ghaibat Kubra, just because we're in the occultation, in the greater occultation, doesn't mean that we close down the religion because the Imam is an occultation. That's, in fact, the whole point is you got to get the religion going again so the Imam comes. It's not that you're just going to sit there and wait, okay. This is the thing that he used to say, which is, you know, nobody denies that even in the greater occultation, things like prayer, fasting, you know, all those things that we consider to be the normal wajib things, that they exist, right? Nobody denies that, right?
Sure.
Nobody says these things are you know, closed down now because the Imam is not present, correct?
Absolutely.
So he said, well, that doesn't. So the same thing goes for having a government. The same thing goes for having a strong Ummah.
Yes.
The same thing goes for.
I couldn't agree more. Mm.
You know, why do we see those things are shut down because of the Ghaibat, and these things aren't? Well, that's more important than this.
Yes, he was saying that. I mean, he said the establishment of an Islamic government is more important than prayer.
Right. So that doesn't mean you don't pray. Of course you pray.
Of course you pray. But your prayer has to have some value. It has to have some meaning.
Right. And so these are all the things. This is the beauty of what Imam was saying.
Yes.
He was a person who really understood Islam.
Yes, he really understood Islam. I think that's you've hit the nail on the head.
You know, we have this famous saying by Shahid Sadr, Shahid Muhammad Baba Sadr, you know, and may God bless his soul. And, you know, he used to talk about, he said, you know, and I'm trying to say it in English.
Yes.
He was talking about Imam and telling his students and telling the people at that time in Najaf and in Iraq, because Imam was there at that time before the revolution. He was saying about, he said, you know, melt, and become one with Imam. Zub.
Yes, very
you
good.
You know, like, you know, like an
you
iron.
You dissolve yourself into,
exactly,
like salt
dissolve.
Does into water.
He said, dissolve yourself into Imam the way Imam dissolved himself into Islam.
Into Islam, mashallah, very nice.
This is the point. Yeah. Here's a man who was completely immersed, dissolved in Islam.
Yes.
And understood it. And was a very capable, you know, advocate of it, and a very capable teacher of Islam.
Sure. The main thing is that, you know, in the last few minutes, if you can sort of just put us in the picture now as to how great the revival has actually been. You know, how great has been the impact on the world at large in terms of what Imam has done?
That's a good question. Now, let's just look at some examples. We can also just, you know, what we've experienced in our own lifetime.
Absolutely.
If you look at a country like Iran, which is a major country in the world, in terms of historically, you
strategically,
know,
yes.
Strategically, civilization.
Wise,
you know,
yes.
Location, geographically, and, you know, its impact culturally, especially in the Muslim world, in this part of the world. Well, obviously, you had this big society and this large country. It is one of the largest, you know, countries of the region.
Oh, it is.
And one of the largest populations. Well, it completely reversed itself from, you know, going down that westernization and that secularization, which was, you know, being forced onto it during the time of the previous regime. Mm. And now it has become this, you know, intense religious, you know, based society. It doesn't mean everybody is religious. It
no.
just means that the framework of the society
is based on religion.
The strategic goals, the laws, and the larger framework in which the society is moving is within the framework of the Quran and the framework of Islam.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
And this has so many consequences for the rest of the world.
It does. Of course it does. It sends out a huge message.
This important nation and this important society moving in this direction. Mm. And the beautiful thing is that it has shown in these last 34 years that you can achieve material and worldly success.
Yes. I mean,
with going in the religious route and going the Islamic route. So it's not about,
you even become more democratic as well, don't you?
Well, everything from democracy to technology to, you know, development to infrastructure to education, you know. All
there's nothing left out.
All the things that they were telling us 30, 40 years ago that you have
to give
up religion and especially give up Islam in order to achieve that. That kind of Turkish model, that kind of, you know, Atatürk.
Yeah.
You know, you have to become European in order to advance.
Yes.
Or the thing which then, you know, Reza Khan in Iran was trying to establish in the you know,
days of the Shah. Yeah, that's right. Yes.
Of course, all of that has been turned on its head.
Exactly.
That
exactly.
Never has in the history of this nation, this country, been so advanced and so, you know, at the forefront of so many things.
Yes, only in the last 34 years.
And it all came after the establishment of an Islamic government.
Absolutely
so
right.
This is a major thing. Then you look at all the other movements that are occurring in places like Lebanon, in Iraq,
and all these
other places,
yeah.
Where people and, you know, Muslims have awakened and have decided that they're not going to stand up to occupation and to oppression.
Sure.
And if you look at the miracles that have happened in Lebanon, so-called, you know, army that couldn't be defeated was defeated.
That's right. We're talking about
you know, the first
Satan Yahu and his Zionists. Yes.
The first Arab army, or the first Arab, you know, I don't even call it army. It's a militia.
It knocked the fourth strongest army off the map.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's funny how you say it. It's just a militia, you know, but, you know, it's like, So the point is that is the point is that
right.
we have these things that are happening in the Islamic world.
Sure.
That are a result of what the Imam was teaching us in terms of following the real Islam.
Exactly. Exactly. And how much
and
of
there
a
are
difference
other things.
That's
so
made.
This was in the Islamic world. You have a lot of the movements that you see in the Sunni world.
Yes.
Taking inspiration from what happened.
Very
Iran
good. Yes.
Imam,
excellent point.
And from
yes.
Imam himself.
Yes.
And across the board, across the Islamic world, you have this general look. Really, this is something that we have to be very clear about.
Mm-hmm.
When Imam came to the scene, the main thesis, the thing that was dominant, the thought that was dominant and that was being, pushed onto everyone was that you have to give up religion and you have to give up Islam
that's
in order
right,
to be
that's
a
right.
civilized human being.
That's a very good point, yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And this was something that was, among the Arab elites, it was all Arab nationalism or it was all socialism and Marxism.
Sure.
If you look at all the elites around the world, it was either you were part of the, American camp or you were part of the Soviet camp.
Yeah, the Soviet camp, yeah.
You were either a liberal or a nationalist
or a Marxist.
Yeah. And here Imam came and said, no, Islam is the real path.
The real way.
Salvation.
Yes.
In this world and in the next.
And in the next.
And notice, because people were like, well, look at what's happening now with these. Well, all these Islamic movements that don't follow the school of Ahlul Bayt or don't follow that kind of, moderate way of looking at things, that way that is based on wisdom that Imam taught us, all of them are failing now.
They are, of course.
And it's interesting, and I think it's very good to look at an example of what is happening, for example, in Egypt.
In Egypt,
the minute,
yes, I was going to say that.
The minute you had the Ikhwan, becoming friendly with the Takfiris, becoming friendly with the Americans, becoming friendly with that American Islam and that kind of, with the enemies of Islam and not following Imam's path, which is that you stand up to the enemies of Islam,
sure,
but that you also are not, that you emphasize unity within Muslims,
sure,
and that you don't try to turn this into a Sunni Shia thing.
Yes.
The minute the Ikhwan started going away from Imam's teachings in these regards, they were completely, defeated.
Exactly.
So this is the thing.
Yeah.
Imam is not just simply a historic thing that happened 34 years ago or 20 years ago. It's not just, something that was for the history books. It was about reviving the fitra and allowing that fitra, which is part of all of humanity, to find its real, goal.
Sure.
And be able to find its perfection. Sure. And that's why to this day, the more time passes, the more he's relevant.
Exactly.
Okay?
The more we realize
what a great, incredible human being he was.
I think Dr. Matthew Traby, on that note, because we've run out of time and it's been great, thanks very much for that valuable contribution you've made today on the subject of how Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, revived religion, not only in the Islamic world, but for the world at large as well. But thanks a lot for your contribution today. I really appreciate
it. My pleasure.
Thank you. And it just
My pleasure.
Yeah, thank you very much. And it just leaves me to say, for the rest of our audience, thank you very much for listening today. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and mercy and blessings of Allah be upon you all. Thank you for listening today, and goodbye.